Hello, everybody. Let me just start this 1 second. Doo-doo-doo. So, this talk, as you, I guess, all know from the program, is called P2P Communism versus the Client-Server State. It's a political economy of network topologies that's sort of reflective of my work over the past few years with the Telecom Minister Collective, and particularly focused on networks for this particular conference. My name is Dmitry Kleiner, and I'm with Telekomministan, and you can, you know, find out some information about us on our website, telekomministan.net. I will use the language of classical political economy and its critics. By networks, I, of course, mean computer networks, like the internet, especially networks connected to the internet. And politics also has a jargon, just like technology does, right? So sometimes the way words are properly understood in colloquial usage is much different than the technical meaning of the definition of the term. And so just to get a few things out of the way, communism does not refer to a form of government in historical or contemporary communist states. It's a theoretical society with no classes and no property. That's so even the communist states, like the Soviet Union or East Germany, would never have claimed to have achieved communism. They would have claimed that they were working towards communism, but they would have claimed that they were some kind of like middle round, whether you buy their, that they were actually trying to achieve communism or not. Nobody would ever have said that they had achieved communism. Communism has always been a theoretical society. And the distinct principles of a communist society is that there's no classes and no state. So it's a peer society, a society where people share and produce as equals. The term originates from the collectivist movement in England and in France, especially among the followers of Robert Owen. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of Robert Owen, but he was an English cooperative pioneer well in the early 19th century, 18th century, so far before Marx or any of the people we associate with communism today. The word came to Marx and Engels, I've heard, through the French community that was inspired by Robert Owen of England. Capitalism also does not refer to the free market, enterprise, business, entrepreneurship, or liberal democracy. Those are not what the word capitalism means. Capitalism refers to a society in which owners appropriate the value created by workers, where a class can exist that doesn't directly contribute to production, but is able to earn an income by appropriating the value created by other producers who employ their property in production. That's the meaning of the word capitalism, right? It doesn't mean the way that it's used very common in the media is not a free market, has a very specific meaning of a class stratified society. It was coined by Thomas Hodgkins and the Ricardian socialists who were responding to political economy, which was the emerging ideology of the capitalist class in the Industrial Revolution. And so it was never a positive term. The people who first started using the term capitalism were using it as a criticism, as a critical term. The original capitalists didn't call themselves capitalists. And the meaning of the term is to draw a correlation with feudalism. So what they meant by capitalism was, again, the stratified society, which ownership of capital gave you a privileged position in the same way the ownership of land did in a feudal society. Right? So that was meant. The origin of the term capitalism is meant to draw a correlation with feudalism, how capital is the new land in the new industrial society, right? And how many people know what capital is? We should mention that as well. It's not in there, but capital in economics is literally the means of production. So it's not money, and it's euphemistically called, money is called capital sometimes because it's earmarked to buy capital, but capital is machines, tools, factories, networks, software, the actual, you know, means of production. So owning that in capitalism gives you the ability to exploit people who need it to actually produce, right? So both economies and networks are composed of relations, right? And that's sort of the point of departure for this whole line of thinking, right? Within economies, you have relationships between landlord and tenant, between employer and employee, between the rich and the poor. And so these relations describe the economy, right? So relations in a network define the topology, right? And relations in an economy define the mode of production, and capitalism is described as a mode of production. Right? Mesh networks, which most probably know, but we'll go over anyway. Mesh networks are networks where all participants can interact, meaning that every node can communicate directly to every other node. Every user, every participant can communicate directly with the other participants of the network. There's no mediation, so there's nobody in the middle that has to like approve or mediate the interaction. Authorization is based on mutual configuration. On a mesh network, if my node is configured to talk to your node, the authorization of what privileges we grant each other is based exclusively on the mutual configuration of our systems, right? And each participant is autonomous. So there's no way for one participant to control another except in mutual configuration with their own system, right? Star networks, which is the other topology of networks, all participants connect with the operator, right? So nobody can communicate directly between nodes. All nodes are connected to the center of the star, which I'm sure, again, most people here know. It's networks 101, right? And all interactions between participants is mediated, which means in order for any participant to communicate with any other participant, the message has to be sent through the central node, through the center of the star. And authorization is granted by the operator. So it's not granted by mutual configuration of the participants. It's granted by the operator. The operator can dictate who is authorized to do what, right? And each participant is thereby dependent on the operator for access to the system, right? So communism is very similar to a mesh network. In communism, all participants produce as equals, right? That's the idea. Producers retain everything they produce, right, because there's no capitalist class. So producers as a whole, as a class, retain the entire value of production. There is no capitalist class that appropriates value by owning the means of production. So what's commonly called interest or rent doesn't exist in a communist system. The direct producers of all value as a class retain the full value of their production, right? And participants produce for social value. Communism is not usually described as a market economy, although there are market socialists and market communists. The use of the word market in those cases is very metaphorical. It's quite distinct from the market as it exists in capitalist society. Things aren't typically exchanged based on individual transactions and prices, but exchanged based on social value, and based on mutual respect and cooperation. Right? So in capitalism, participants are divided into classes. Right. Once again, you have the landlord class, capitalist class, and the worker class. And these classes have to do with relationship to the factors of production. So within the productive cycle, there are several factors, land, labor, capital being the classic ones. And relationship to the factors of production is what the term is, the economic class. So it's not like the social classes. It's not like the middle class, the rich and the poor. It's not like the estate system of like France. It's a very materialist class system that's based on very tangible relationships to the means of production. And it also shouldn't be concerned with individuals, because individuals can often be all three to a certain degree. It's concerned with classes and social classes, right? So by and large, most people have to work and continuously sell their labor in order to make a living. And this is called the worker class. Even if each individual worker may also capture some rent and profit through some marginal way, the point is they can't continue to survive unless they continue to sell their labor. Whereas another class of people that doesn't have to work at all because they own the means of production, and so they're able to appropriate part of the output of the direct producers and retain it as their own income without contributing, right? So property owners appropriate wealth from producers. Participants produce for exchange value. So this is much different than producing for social value, right? Because like when you produce for exchange value, you have to be able to capture that price. When you produce for social value, you're only producing it because it's, you know, something your community wants or something that out of mutual respect and cooperation you want to do or people want. Whereas in for exchange value, it has to be something that can be directly measured as a price. And for instance, the market system, which is what exchange value represents, you know, is famously bad at rewarding things like child rearing, artistic production, things that aren't readily commodifiable in terms of things you can actually sell for a price. So generalized value production within a community is not well valued in exchange, right? And exchange is based on market price, and that's of course important, right? So capitalists love star networks, right? Because the capitalist is the operator. Roles and credentials create classes. And mediation is needed to charge a price. In order to be able to exact a price, you have to be in the middle of the relationship, right? If the relationship is happening around you, you can't impose a toll on that relationship, right? So capitalists hate mesh networks because participants can interact directly, thereby exchanging value directly on their own terms and routing around the profit capture mechanisms of the capitalists, right? Well, there's no toll gates, there's also no prices, and that's why capital has a really hard time with mesh networks. The internet was not created by capitalists. The internet was developed by universities, NGOs, hobbyists, and the military. And again, I'm sure most of you know this story of where the internet comes from. It wasn't funded by speculative capital. It was funded by educational research and other kinds of research and just hobbyist participation adopted by NGOs and so forth, right? Capitalists had their own idea of the information superhighway that was developing in parallel at the time. This was called the online service. And they developed things like CompuServe, AOL, Prodigy, and things like that. That was capital's idea of what the online world would look like, right? And all of these, and up until the 90s, major corporations had no real internet strategy. The internet really came out of nowhere for most of capital, right? And capitalist online services are, again, client-server systems which employ a star topology. If you're a CompuServe user, or I don't think it's around anymore, but if you were a CompuServe user, you can only communicate to other CompuServe users through CompuServe system, and if CompuServe didn't allow you to communicate, then you couldn't, right? It was completely controlled, right? But the internet was host to numerous peer-to-peer systems like email, Usenet, IRC, which depend on a mesh topology. Right, none of these systems like email, Usenet, or IRC can work in a star topology because your email server communicates directly with the email server, the person you're sending email to. Same with the way Usenet servers exchange mail or IRC operates. Right, so it depends on a mesh topology. You can't operate in a star topology. Right, but because the internet is a peer system, anybody with a connection to it can also connect others. You can pass on the connection because it's a peer-to-peer system. So if you have access to the internet, you can also connect somebody else to the internet, right? And this created a boom of internet service providers, right? All of a sudden, there was like internet service providers everywhere, just exploded out of nowhere in the 90s, and this caught capitalists by surprise. They weren't expecting this. They weren't following this research. They weren't really involved with it, and they certainly didn't see it coming, right? And what's interesting is the exchange value these ISPs were capturing was collectively created, right? The value that these ISPs were selling, right, comes from the size of the network. So it wasn't the particular infrastructure a given ISP had that was the reason people would subscribe to it. It was to access the internet, right? So each ISP was independently earning income, right? Being part of a common platform not owned by any one of them as a whole, but actually composed of their interconnections, right? So this does not really resemble a market economy, but rather it resembles a network economy. It's not the actual ISP wasn't selling itself. It was selling a connection to the internet. And the value of what it was selling wasn't driven by its own assets. It was driven by the value of this collective network, which was because of the size of the network, right? So capitalists were not happy about this, right? So the first level of enclosure started with what was known as the dot-com boom, right? Which I'm sure, again, many people here probably remember. And the capitalists simply bought everything they could. That was like they threw money around randomly, lost huge amounts of money, basically buying absolutely everything they could find or see, right? And if you had internet access in the mid-90s, it was from a mom-and-pop ISP with a shelf full of consumer-grade modems, if it was commercial internet, if it was university, it was different, right? But today, access is mostly provided by giant telecom cooperatives. Most of us have accounts with, like, Vodafone or T-Mobile or, like, T-Home, whatever they call it, right? And the mom-and-pop ISPs were literally all bought out. And not only bought out, but the level of capitalization that they had to put up with also became too much for them. So consumer modems didn't cut it anymore. When capital got involved, you needed real heavy iron equipment to really compete. When things like ADSL were introduced, all of a sudden you needed to have really intensive capital infrastructure in order to provide this kind of a service, and the mom and pop couldn't really compete. And so they were gone. Now, but there was still a problem. It was still a peer-to-peer network, right? And so it was still largely a system of value, and so communism itself had to be driven from the network, right? And that, we all fondly remember, which is still happening, is what Web 2.0 means. right? The Web 2.0 was the second wave of the enclosure of the internet, right? Because the web, although it runs on a peer-to-peer network, the web is actually a client-server application where each operator has exclusive control over all interactions that happen through their website. So a web-based platform, again, even though you reach it over the peer-to-peer internet, the actual application itself is a client-server application, and the operator has complete control. So each website is a star topology, right? And so we see Usenet being replaced by web forums, email being replaced by social media sites such as Facebook, right? IRC being replaced by Twitter, et cetera. And all of these things are centrally owned and centrally operated star topology-based systems. So not only is the infrastructure been completely bought up and consolidated, but actually the peer-to-peer architecture is being taken away from the network because of its incompatibility with capitalism, right? And the core innovation of the internet was its P2P architecture. That's why the internet destroyed CompuServe and AOL and friends. It was exactly the explosive growth caused by its P2P architecture that made the internet special, right? But P2P has now become a contraband, right? If you look in the media and common discourse, P2P is something used by thieves, pirates, and other criminals. You rarely hear P2P mentioned in a positive sense anymore in the mainstream media. It's always about theft. It's always about exploitive software. It's malware, right? And P2P is being engineered out of the internet, right? The system of cloud computing, of hosted online applications, of all kinds, there's all kinds of things that are making the internet more and more of a client-server architecture. Even though it's still built on a net topology, TCP/IP being still a mesh topology, the application layer is being completely replaced with client-server architecture where individual operators control all interaction through their site and are able to capture value, right? So venture capitalism uses privileged access to accumulated wealth of the past, right? And capitalists capture the wealth of the future by offering each generation of innovators a chance to join their club by selling the future value of what they create in exchange for the present wealth they require to get started, right? So because you can't actually build anything without having a certain amount of wealth in order to build it with, right? The capitalists are able to capture every new generation of innovation by simply buying the technology as it's being developed, because the people developing it need their money in order to develop it, and so they're quite willing to sell the future value of it in order to be able to actually create it in the present, right? And so the dead stolen value of the past captures the unborn value of the future. And so this becomes a self-replicating system, or what's called social reproduction, right? If we're to have a free society modeled after peer networks and free software, gift economies, the pastoral commons, and other examples of more equal and free ways of interacting, we need to find a way for innovation to be born free, to be born not already sold, right? We need a way to fund innovation collectively that doesn't have it captured, owned, proprietary, right from the onset, right? And capitalists will not fund P2P. Capitalism requires enclosure. Without privileged access to scarce resources, it can't capture profit. I think we've been pretty clear on that, right? It needs to have privileged access in order to capture profit. If everybody has everything, then profit can't be captured, right? And capitalism requires mediation. Because of its exploitive nature and because it's capturing value, this capture can only work if it lies in the middle of relationships, if it lies between producer and consumer. Right? If the capitalist can't be in the middle of the relationship, they can't capture value. A very good example of this is what we see in the war against the file sharers that the music industry is undertaking. Right? The pretense of the music industry is that these users are stealing their music. Right? That's what they say all the time. And the pretense that they're stealing their music, they're downloading it for free and therefore stealing it, right? But in actual fact, the music industry gives away music for free all the time, right? From promotions, from radio, from all kinds of things. They actually have no problem with giving away music for free. That's just a pretense. What really terrifies them is not being in the middle of the relationship between the artist and the fan. If the fans and the artist can interact directly, then the music industry is reduced to being a service bureau. And there's no champagne lunches in the service bureau industry. It's just a pure commodity industry. Right? So capitalism requires a star topology. Right? Well, do we already have that, Oni? Right. That. Right? I guess we're already looping. Yeah, so there we go. So if we cannot find alternative to capitalist financing, it's not only the internet as we know it that we're going to lose, but also the chance to remake society in its image, right? Because the internet represents a whole another set of social relationships that possibly haven't existed before on anything of its scale. The ability of people in a peer-to-peer network and a mesh topology to share as equals and to communicate as equals is something that's never existed before. But it's not only that that we'll lose if we can't find a way to stop the steamrolling of venture capital. It's actually, we also lose the opportunity to change society in the image of the internet and make society itself more free, more open, and more equality. And so in order to create a society where we produce and share as equals, we need venture communism. And I'm not going to go any farther than that. Venture communism is something that is a concept that I've been working on for a while, and we're not going to get into it here, but you can ask questions about it or whatever, and we can talk about it. But I'm going to leave it there more of a concept rather than my particular suggestions of how venture communism might work. It's more the idea of venture communism, the idea that we have to work together and create mutual wealth that allows us to build infrastructure based on social value and based on equality and based on sharing. And that was pretty fast, but I think that let's just go into questions and discussion and see what you all think. So any questions? Yep.
The notion of venture communism, isn't that just what universities should be for? State pays for most of the research and development.
Yeah.
In Germany, and shouldn't it be, can we just call universities venture communism?
Well, not really. University financing, as we said, has been critical in the development of the internet, and it's certainly, and you know, also the labor of students and research projects in universities certainly contribute a lot. But universities are still a part of the capitalist system, and so is the state, right? So they will contribute things, but the internet's an exception. Normally radical things aren't on purpose built by the universities and the state. The internet is an exception, and the specific reasons for it, right? Because the military was interested in creating an uninterruptible network, and again, I don't need to go over the history of the internet with everybody here, because I'm sure most people here know it. But I would say that the universities are unlikely to produce anything radical. While they are likely to produce useful things, I think the internet is really an exception in them actually producing something that's so radical and so different that it changes social relationships. So yes, they can play a role, but I don't think it's enough. I think that we have to go beyond a society where we have this model of capital, state, university, and embrace a model that looks more like a peer-to-peer network, where we really work together and develop a common platform that we all then employ to create wealth. Oh, go ahead, yeah.
Does your model of a mesh network include that all nodes are kind of equal?
Well, that's a technical question. I mean, obviously the internet is not a pure mesh network because it's a asynchronous mesh, right? But it's not like a fully meshed mesh, right, where every node has direct physical link to every other node. I don't think that matters so much. I think it's more the concept of the mesh network. So long as every node can communicate directly with any other node, even if it passes through other nodes as sort of a common carrier kind of routing, I think that's okay. Because, I mean, if you look at the way the internet is right now, I know the net neutrality thing is a big issue now, and even that's being degraded, but at least so far, the network itself is more or less a neutral network. And again, that's one of the things that's going to change, because now I'm sure people here know about the net neutrality discussion, where internet service providers are creating sort of different classes of websites. So like, you know, you have fast access to Google, but to like the EFF, maybe not so fast, right? And that's another way in which capital is engineering P2P out of the internet. But I think just passing through another node is okay, so long as it's a neutral node.
I think you're right. It's not a good idea to force people to use centralized services, but maybe it's us, the technicians, who force the people to do this, because we have somehow fucked it all up. in my point of view, we have forgotten to
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they can do it without a centralized intermediate.
Well,
because even if they somehow manage to put them on the kind of web server,
mm-hmm. Usenet, for instance, was running.
Mm-hmm. You need a kind of dynamic DNS update, mm-hmm. which is, of course, it's possible, but it's too hard for many people.
Sure.
So there are technologies like White Area Bonjour.
Mm-hmm.
You heard of it,
mm-hmm.
but it's not that common, and it's still got a lot of problems.
Well, we have.
Even if we solve this, mm-hmm. there's still no kind of peer-to-peer authentication, so which is decentralized. So even if somehow we manage to put up we've got no technical infrastructure to authenticate different kinds of people. If I look at myself and I share some photos on my own web server, password protected,
mm-hmm.
some technical aware friends, maybe all of the time, about 50% of them, they forgot their password. We need
Well, in order to build better technical solutions, we need to have the wealth to do so. The vast majority of people that work in technology aren't independently wealthy and can't just simply make whatever technology they want to make. They make what their employers want them to make. And if you look at the logic of capitalism, things that have a star topology will have lots and lots and lots of money, and things that have a mess topology won't. And that's really where there's reasons that millions and millions go into systems like Twitter and Facebook, right? That they have access to all the money they want. Essentially, they're just, you know, given money. They can lose money for decades. It doesn't matter because there's a compatibility between their business model and the one of the investors. Whereas in Usenet, which has been, you know, in existence since the 70s, right? It's 1979, which was a way of sharing pictures, sharing text, citizen journalism. You could pretty much do everything on Usenet that you can do on modern-day social media. But, of course, the interfaces are old-fashioned. They haven't been invested in. They haven't been brought up to date, right? So Usenet is like a submerged, lost island underneath the Internet sea somewhere, and it's been more or less abandoned. And it's not that there's anything wrong with it. Actually, architecturally, it's far superior to Facebook or whatever. The problem is nobody will pay for it, because why would they? Why would the capitalists pay to build a system where they can't capture any value? A system that's owned by everyone, controlled by everyone, and so therefore there's no place for them to put their toll gate.
Diaspora.
Yeah, but I mean that's a really good example. I mean Diaspora is probably the most exciting thing to happen in that field for a while now. But you know, let's compare the scale. I mean, Diaspora has a huge success of having raised just over $100,000 from Kickstarter, which is a peer financing platform. And $100,000. So we're talking about, in technology world, we're talking about 2 man years. That's it, right? So you've got 2 man years of like capital for Diaspora, and how much for Facebook, right? And so, pardon? Yeah. Exactly right. So, and again, no disrespect to Diaspora. It's a very exciting project, and I wish them well.
Good. Yeah, but it's kind of the defining thing about most of the free software and stuff that's happening, peer production.
Right.
That it's done in people who actually have jobs, but maybe on their idle time or after work. Or
yeah, but there's a big difference.
I mean, this is kind of not true all the time, but it's kind of.
There's a big difference economically between what's called producers' goods and what's called consumers' goods, right? Wealth and capital. Ironically, within capitalism, the one thing that can be free is capital. If you're building capital, you can make that available for free. And that's why things like Apache and infrastructure-based software, Linux, you know, tons of companies will pay for it, because they don't capture value directly through Linux or Apache. They capture value by employing it in production of other things. So a web hosting company captures value from selling web hosting, not from controlling Apache. So capital, which is an input to production, can be free in capitalism. There's no problem. They don't need to capture wealth on their own tools, right? In fact, they don't want to. What they don't want is consumer items to be free, because then they can't capture profits from consumer value, right?
Do you mean that just in terms of internet and
I don't understand the question, sorry.
Does your idea of federal communism apply not just to internet?
No, not at all. No, not at all. It's my idea of venture communism is to create a cooperative way of financing a shared common platform in the material world, and it has to include material assets. Otherwise, it can't really make any social change. Well, I wouldn't say anything can't be a part of venture communism. I think that it's not a replacement for venture communism. I think that that's more my position. Sure, universities, like I said, in particular, the labor of students is particularly like rich and valuable stock that can be put to really good use and has been throughout, you know, for a very long time, particularly in technology, where a lot of interesting combinations come from that. Absolutely, venture communism. My idea of venture communism is just a different kind of like joint stock corporation where people have equal ownership and things like that. And again, I don't want to talk too much about my particular model because I'm throwing it out more as an idea, and my model is by no means the only one that can be considered. But the idea of venture communism is just that we do business together. Venture communism is not a kind of a society. It's an alternative to venture capitalism. It's specifically proposed as an alternative to venture capitalism. So rather than creating this reproduction system of creating private property and hierarchical organizations and market-based transactions, create a system that creates that opposite, that creates sharing systems and equal relationships, right? Is there a question over there? No? Oh, okay. Anybody else? Go ahead, please.
I think
you just talked.
There's something possible like this in our society without a revolution. I think we're so immersed in the capitalist society that there is no way within the system to beat the system.
Well, there is a valid argument, but the problem with that argument is that all capacities are at their base economic capacities. So no matter what you're saying we have to do, we have to find a way to create the wealth to apply to that eventuality, even a violent revolution, right? So if we can't build the wealth to build our own alternatives to venture capital, where are we going to build the wealth in order to fund a violent revolution, right? So if you can't have one, you can't have the other either, right? Unless you believe in some kind of like apocalyptic, messianic, spontaneous, like uprising, right? Which I'm not, you know, holding my breath for, right? It is a struggle, and we have to build the capacity to struggle, and we have every reason to believe that, you know, like, you know, bottom up revolution will face top down repression, and there will be fights along the way, but it doesn't mean that we have to focus on violent revolution. What we have to focus on is capacity building. We have to focus on building the capacity to engage in struggle, however we engage in that struggle. And I personally believe that we have a long way to go before we need to worry about direct confrontation. I mean, like, you know, this community is so obscure at the moment that it's, you know, the free software community is hardly like, you know, the main threat to to capital, right? So I think that's, you know, there's the validity to that point, but in the end we have to build capacity somehow. And we have to build capacity towards any form of struggle. Anything else? Oh, there we go.
Do you think that there are other ideas that are along the lines of eventual communism, which are similar and interesting that people might look at?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the history this is why I use the term communism is to connect it with that historic struggle, because it's been going on for centuries. I said back to Robert Owen and the cooperative movement. A movement called anarcho-syndicalism, syndicalism in general, mutualist anarchism. These are all the work of, like, you know, I'm sure you've heard of Pierre Proudhon, Silvio Gesell, and all kind. There's really a centuries old tradition in this kind of thinking. Even like the IWW, the International Workers of the World, right? The you know, building the new society within the shell of the old, organizing not only for the eventual overthrow of capitalism, but also for the day-to-day maintenance of the struggle. And so within anarchist and communist tradition, these ideas are quite old, and that's exactly why I use the term communism, in order to connect it to that tradition. Is that it? Anything else? That's right. Yeah, Marx.
Right. Of course, it won't come by itself.
Right.
But people who don't own anything will have to take over the needs of production by themselves. They have to take the factories and turn them into their own and reorganize and remake.
Right.
I want to make, when you mentioned the Web 2.0,
That
is something, it's a movement in the other direction. So the people who, with the internet, have the means of production in their hands, give them away and turn the other way.
There's a lot of talk about like things like Web 2.0 and social media as putting the hands of the means of production in the hands of the people, but I have a big problem with that point of view, because immaterial assets can't directly capture exchange value, and as long as we're material creatures and require food and shelter, I can't just having access to Facebook doesn't change the fact that I have to sell my labor in order to survive, right? I mean, Marx is very ambiguous in his whole relationship with syndicalist approaches. I mean, on one hand he tried to recruit Proudhon, on the other hand he called him a petit bourgeois, a reformist, right? The relationship between anarchist communism and Marx is a complex, very nuanced and dicey one, where there's a lot of criticism, mutual criticism, but also a lot of agreement and a lot of cooperation. I disagree with this notion, as I was saying to this gentleman over there, that like this idea of spontaneous revolution. I mean, in the Critique of Political Economy, Marx talks about how the forces of production will eventually overcome the relations of production, and I think this is a really important thing. And I think this is one of the best contributions from Marx on this topic. You know, of course, he was talking about the Industrial Revolution and the factory system, right? But the forces of production, as people start to work differently, they also start to build different relationships. And so Marx placed a lot of hope and like solidarity among factory workers in industrial Britain as taking over the factories they were working in. And I guess, as we all know, that didn't pan out quite that way. But I think, you know, that more or less can be applied to seeing the internet as a new set of social relationships. Fine. Wow, we made it the whole hour? Amazing. So as new social relationships emerge, if they can become economic relationships, the forces of production can change the relations of production. And that doesn't necessarily have to be some kind of spontaneous violent overthrow. It could be, but it can also take place in other ways. It can also take place in a more peaceable or gradual transition, but it's nonetheless equally revolutionary, because anything that changes the fundamental relations of society is a revolutionary strategy. It's not a reformist strategy, right? It's only a reformist strategy if you try to kind of like mitigate the excesses of the bad society by fixing certain aspects of it. If the end goal is the complete revolutionization of the mode of production, then that's a revolutionary strategy, even if guns aren't part of the plan. And I guess we'll leave it at that. Oh, one more question?
Do you think all the content that is being downloaded over the internet
Yeah, well, that's the slogan of Telekomunistin is the revolution is calling, and in many ways I mean that literally. Like by using international telecommunications, we're engaging in new kinds of social relationships that are themselves the making of the revolution, because we're changing the way we interact with each other, and this is why we have to defend the internet as it exists, so that these kinds of social relations aren't eliminated and captured. I guess that's it. Thanks, everyone.